Welcome to On Air with the Mountain Lion Foundation, broadcasting research and policy discussions to understand the issues that face the American lion. My name is Julie West. Mm-hmm. I'm here with the director of the International Exotic Animal Sanctuary, Richard Gilbert. And this is somewhat of a unique conversation today because I'm actually here at the sanctuary outside Boyd, Texas, and had the benefit of touring the grounds a little moment ago. So I'm going to be speaking with Richard about some of the challenges and rewards he faces being a director of a unique sanctuary like this. Richard, how long have you been the director?
Since 1996.
1996. And what prompted you into this particular line of work?
Well, I've always worked with animals all my life. I'm an animal science major. I graduated from Tarleton State University. I was an ag teacher for a while. I've worked with the game and fish departments in New Mexico and Colorado on problem bears and stuff back in the 70s. And I've done a lot of artificial inseminating and with cattle and stuff back in Louisiana back in the 80s. So I've dealt with animals of some sort all my life.
Now, this sanctuary is not a rehabilitation sanctuary. It's, as you spoke with me on the phone yesterday, really kind of a last stop for many of these animals. Talk about that a little bit.
This is the last hope that some of these animals had, was us taking them. A couple of the animals, you know, I got emails that said, you know, if you can't take them, they're going to be euthanized in 5 hours and that kind of stuff. So we're the last hope that some of these animals have. And others, most all of our animals have been seized from individuals that could no longer care for them, or they didn't have any business caring for them, or they didn't have the proper permits and licenses, and they were seized by the USDA, U.S. Fish and Wildlife. We've got a number of animals here that were seized by the DEA. So all of our animals didn't come from what you consider a great background.
Many of them traumatized, raised as pets, gambled. I'm sure the...
When we get these animals, they have all sorts of problems, not only emotionally, but physically. We've had a lot of cats that come here that are declawed, that their teeth have been pulled so people could play with them. Emotionally, that we've had cats that and bears that have came here that have been in small enclosures. And when I say small enclosures, I'm talking about 4x4x8 for 14 years, stuff like that. So not only do these cats have physical problems, they got enormous amount of emotional problems. And we're a little bit different than most facilities that you'll ever run into. You know, most places figure that they need shelter, food, and some type of behavioral enrichment. Now, we throw in the fourth one, which is emotional enrichment. And we believe that all of these animals have emotions just like you and I do. Now, some of these big cats, yes, they have the only emotion that they don't have that we have, they have, is they have no inhibition about killing you. But far as liking you, disliking you, having a good day, bad day, they're all the same. You know, they're fall right in with us.
Well, how many cats do you have?
Right now we have 52.
52 cats. And I know the sanctuary is not limited to cats, but for our purposes, we're going to focus on the cats today. And how many mountain lions do you have?
Right now, we only have two.
Okay. And can you tell us a little bit about those mountain lions and their backgrounds? How long have they been here?
BB has been here going on 17 years. He's a female mountain lion. Why I named BB, I don't know, but that's what it was named when I came. So BB was found in a trailer house in Plano, Texas, with a tiger. And he lived next to that tiger all his life. So Then we have Indito, which is a female mountain lion, too, that was brought here 16 years ago as a baby. Some idiot had purchased her and then couldn't care for her. So she ended up here. So you'll have to remember, mountain lions in Texas are considered predators, so they didn't have any, if they didn't have a place like this to go to, they would have been put to death.
I see.
And I say death instead of euthanized because I want to stress the point.
You have a good reputation as a sanctuary nationally, and I understand the American Association of Zoos has actually recognized the work you do. Why don't you talk a little bit about that process of, is it called accreditation? Or
We're certified. Now, when I first got here years ago, we looked for something to set us aside from other sanctuaries. The word sanctuary is probably one of the most abused words in the English language, in my opinion. People say they have sanctuaries, but they also do breeding, they also do photos, they also do picture taking, they let people touch them and they let them play with them. We don't do any of that. This is the cat's home and we treat it as such. We honor their wishes. If they're having a bad day, we work around them. Although most of the animals now, they enjoy our company. They enjoy us working around them. They lay out there and watch us and bask in the sun and really enjoy it. Now, that's the reason we tried to get in the AZA. No sanctuary had ever gotten certified or accredited by the AZA ever.
No kidding.
We were the first, and we're still the first. We're still the only one that's ever made it.
So what happens in that process? They visit your grounds. They observe what you do. Tell us a little bit about that.
When you first start, you get an application, and it took me 3 months to complete this application. You have to have protocols for everything from escapes to natural disasters to blood to quarantine procedures, everything in the world that you can imagine. You have to have some type of procedure on file and approved by them. And once you get all of that done, you're inspected by a group of inspectors from the AZA, and they write their recommendations, and they also may have what they call their concerns. And they give you amount of time to correct the concerns if you have some concerns. And we were lucky. I think we had 3 concerns when we did this. Now, they inspect you every 5 years to renew your certification and accreditation. Then you have to go to before a accreditation board of 15 people that are directors from other zoos across the United States. And they yay or nay you. So the first time we were tabled.
And what does that mean?
They didn't know what to do with us.
Oh.
We're not a zoo.
Because you were the first sanctuary.
That's right. We were not a zoo. They did not know where to put us. So basically what they have ended up doing, they put us under what they consider related facilities. Now, the only thing that is difference between the related facility and the zoo accreditation, they certify us. And what that means was we don't open our doors to the public, where they can roam freely throughout the park. And after you've been on the tour, you can see why you couldn't allow people to just roam freely here. Plus, if you go to zoos and stuff, you see people whistling at the animals, throwing popcorn, throwing rocks, beating on the glass, doing something to make the animals move, and there are exhibits there. They're not an animal. They're exhibits. And here, this is their place. We're nonprofit, and it's theirs. It don't belong to anybody else other than the animals that are here.
Did you find that the certification enabled you for a certain level of funding that maybe you didn't have access to before? Or has that made a difference in the support you get?
The funding has not made any difference to us. Matter of fact, it hasn't done what I had hoped, but it did set us aside from a lot of other sanctuaries, the so-called sanctuaries across the United States. And it's allowed us to be recognized by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and we get more calls from them to help them. It also allows us to train individuals, interns here, that get AZA experience. They have to get it at an AZA facility, and we have a large educational program for college students that's got out of college where they can move on to zoos and other animal facilities and get jobs.
Yes, and I met some of your interns earlier today. So how many at a time do you take?
We take 8 at a time on a 3-month deal. We do a quarter, and we also have a 6-month intern program. Like last time we had 8, and 6 of those 8 got jobs and are working right now. So
very good. And do you have a vet here on the grounds or a relationship with an animal hospital?
I don't have a vet on grounds. I have a vet on call. He lives 1 mile from us, and we're really lucky to have Dr. Moore. His wife is also a vet, and both of them have treated an enormous amount of exotic animals in their lifetime. Plus, we have another vet to the south of us here that also treats tigers, that is very familiar with tigers and big cats. And between those two vets, they have probably treated more big cats than any other vet in this country right now. So,
well, very good. Very good.
But we get a vet tech from his office once a week that comes out, visually inspects all the cats, goes through all of our data that we catch or that we take every day that we feed, visual what type of medication the vet's got them on, and we administer that medication ourselves. If it's something as far as a dart, a shot, or something. He handles that, or the vet tech does.
Well, given your reputation, do you sometimes get animals from zoos? Do zoos ever give you aging animals or call you?
I get calls sometimes. But my question with vets, with zoos, are you going to help us? We're going to take this exhibit that you have made hundreds of thousands of dollars from, and it's just got old, and it's no longer a good exhibit. You got to help us take care of it for the rest of its life.
Fair enough. And does that happen?
Very few times, but it has. They, you know, I've had a couple that's offered us $1,000 to take a tiger that's going to live another 10 years. And right now, our tigers are costing us, our overhead on one tiger is about $600 a month.
Wow.
Now that includes insurance, electricity, food, medicine, maintenance on their habitats, all of that. It's overhead, all
right,
rolled into one. But most zoos will not send money along to help their animal.
So you rely on private donations?
Yes. Oh, yes. We don't get any help from the government, from the state. All of our funds come from private individuals that are caring. We also get, we write probably 500 grants a year. We do in-kind goods. I know we're not talking about bears right now, but we do get meat from, we have a store in Walmart in Fort Worth that's giving us, donating us stuff that's going to be outdated in a day. And we go pick it up, and we're getting probably anywhere between 500 and 600 pounds of meat every Monday, and probably 4,000 or 5,000 pounds of produce.
Wow!
So
good.
We do a little bit of everything to make all of this work.
Yeah. Now let's jump back for a minute. Well, I guess I have two questions, but one is, you talked about the emotional as well as physical well-being of the animal, and I know you have an animal behaviorist, don't
Correct.
You?
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about that person's role with the cats.
This individual has been working with animals for over 40 years.
Wow.
If you go back and look, the AZA never required any facility to have a behavioralist on staff until 2006.
Why?
they didn't figure it was important. You have to remember, you start saying these animals have emotions and they have feelings, you're treading in a very ripply area, because if you get into some of that part, then you get involved with some of your other organizations like PETA and all that. So you have to tread wherever you're going to go, because they really didn't want people to think that animals had emotions, had feelings, and had all of this. Like operative conditioning and stuff. We've been doing operative conditioning here and emotional enrichment for as long as I've been here, since 95.
So tell me, what does that mean? How does that translate in a day-to-day typical interaction with some of the cats?
Well, like emotional enrichment, you'll notice when we go out and feed, they'll come right up to us, to the edge of the pen. They'll jump up on their perch and let me look at them, inspect them. They'll chuff, rub their heads up against the fence. They'll turn down, lay down. I've even went as far as giving a big lion down here a transfusion without sedation. I've never sedated any animal on this park to move them, ever.
So there's some trust there.
There's a lot of trust, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I respect them and they respect me. And it's really unique that the animals can know the difference between me, the girls that feed them, mm-hmm. the keepers, and the behavioralist. And over the years, you know, we put forth this behavioral program to the AZA back in 2001. And basically they looked at it as this person was just playing with a pet. That's how they sensed it, and that's the way they reacted to it. And so it's took a long time. Well, it's not really long, it's 10 years, but that's a while, for them to realize that some of the stuff that we're doing here has been really on the cutting edge of becoming connected with these animals in different ways that they've never seen.
No, I'm very interested in that. And if you read about Jane Goodall, mm-hmm. and her work with the chimps, that was considered incredibly yes. unconventional. People poo-pooed her. They thought she was crazy. Mm-hmm. And here she's really forged the way for mm-hmm. Many other behaviorists. And so, yeah, why not the Jane Goodall of cats?
Yeah, there's lots of, you know, lots of things that we have done. You know, I've had a cat here that got a bone stuck on his tooth. It's one of his big canines. And this big lion allowed the behaviorist to get a hold of it and pull it off, or we would have had to sedate him.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there is a mutual trust with these animals. Now, okay, you have to remember, these are animals. And there is some animals that still won't trust you. There's no difference. It's just like people, you know. Some people will trust you to a certain point, and then they won't trust you. These animals are basically the same way. You know, they're, our behavioralist, with new animals that come in, he works with them to get them to a point to allow us to work around them. Because we're going to have to take care of them for 20 years. Mm-hmm. So wouldn't it make sense for this animal to be comfortable with our presence while we're doing what we need to do to give them a quality of life for the next 20 years? Mm-hmm. And so that's one of our major points as we work on that.
I noticed there are a lot of toys mm-hmm. for the cats. Mm-hmm. And so they must get a lot of enjoyment with their tires and...
Oh, they love their tires. Now, some of these big cats love... They think the tire is like a pacifier for a little kid. And all the big cats have pools, tigers, because they love water. Jag's got water and everything. We also, I don't know if you noticed, that we have a mister system that's all over this all area down here. It's got about 10 mister tips for each enclosure, which, you know, being 30 today, we don't have, it's not on. It's in the summertime.
But on a hot Texas day.
Hot Texas day, it's on and it's working, and they know exactly where the mister tips are.
They're standing under the mister tips.
That's where they're at. They're laying there, yeah. You know.
Well, I want to get back to another point. You had said sometimes you are consulted by game and fish folks. Does that mean they might find an orphaned mountain lion cub or some other?
Normally on the mountain lion cubs and stuff, that is pretty rare. In all the years I've been doing this is one on the mountain lions. Bears, I get calls during the springtime on bears constantly because their moms are getting killed. They're getting run over on the cars, by cars on the highways and everything. Far as the big cats, the tigers and the lions, I get most of all of my calls from the USDA and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife and the Game and Fish Department are big animals because they don't find them until there are people having problems with them. You know, as long as they're babies, most people never see them. They're hid. But once you get a tiger that's weighing 200 and 300 pounds, it's hard to keep him in the house. You know.
No kidding.
So those, by the time I hear about it from the Game and Fish or some legal entity, they're usually 1 year old or older.
Okay. Well, when we spoke briefly on the phone the other day, you surprised me by saying that there's a resurgence of mountain lions in North Texas. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you'll have to look at, I grew up in North Texas, South Amarillo. Back in the 60s and 70s, there wasn't any deer in that country. There were no turkeys. There were no deer. There were no wild hogs. There wasn't any of that. Basically, the only animals that you've seen in that country was maybe bobwhite quail and rattlesnakes. About 10 years ago, there was an influx of migrating deer from New Mexico, Colorado, and Oklahoma moving in to North Texas along the Red River, along the Canadian, moving down towards this way. And a lot of the reason for that was a lot of this land that was once farmed back in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s was all put into CRP. That's a government program where they pay the farmer not to farm it, and they plant grass, and it goes back to just nature, the way it was 100 years ago when the buffalo roamed here. Well, these animals are all moving into this country now because they have places to hide. They have a natural type habitats that's coming up again. And now, all the way down to Wichita Falls, Denton in here, we've got wild feral hogs, we got turkeys, we got mule deer, we got whitetail deer, and what is their predator? The mountain lion. It's coming right behind them because, you know, food.
Sure.
They're
going to
follow the food.
So I wonder then, with that change, if game management policies have changed in Texas?
Not in Texas, no. The mountain lion is still considered a predator. And you can, if you call the Texas Parks and Wildlife tomorrow and tell them you have a mountain lion out there that you saw that you're afraid it may kill one of your horses, colts, or something, they'll just tell you, well, if you see it again, shoot it. That's it. That's as far as they're going. They're not going to open up that can of wax where they're going to start, protecting it or managing the hunting part of it or any of it.
Well, it just seems like if you're encouraging the land to revert back to a natural prairie state, which then in turn will attract all these other animals, then you better be prepared for...
Well, that, you have to remember that's a Game and Fish, and that's some of their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
I'm sure that there's someone working on mountain lion policy at this point. It's something that we're not privy to at this time.
Well, you have beautiful grounds here.
Thank you.
Tell us how many acres you have total.
Got 40 acres.
40 acres.
I would love for you to be here in the spring when everything is green and all the vines on the habitats are green and the flowers are blooming. That's when it's really pretty. And all the animals are laying out on their perches, sunning and stuff. That's when it's really nice and enjoyable. But, you know, we have to go through winter, and everybody's pretty much in their houses because it's cool.
Well, I'll be sure to visit in the spring.
Good.
Well, thank you for the service you provide these animals. That's important work you and your team are doing.
Well, I appreciate it, and they appreciate it. It's something that I think it's gratifying for all of us.
Take care.
Thank you.
This has been a Mountain Lion Foundation On Air broadcast. On Air is a copyrighted production of the Mountain Lion Foundation. Permission to rebroadcast is granted for non-commercial use. For more information, visit mountainlion.org.